real names? Did you have pseudonyms that you didn't know that you didn't know who he was?
No, nobody knew real names. No, they were all fake names. Yeah, so, sorry, yes.
Okay, yeah, so please continue.
He said, well, don't you know anything about him? I said, I think I know one thing. He was a shoemaker in regular life. Oh, says Lou. Oh, I know who that was. He wasn't a shoemaker. His father was. That was Jan Karman. Oh, is that his name? Yeah, his name is Jan Karman. I said, but Ed, that's impossible because Jan Karman was with me when we ran out of the hut. So we talked and talked, and I convinced him that he was mistaken. I said, no, Lou, he was with me in the woods, you know, and with my mother and all that. All right, he said. I guess maybe my memory is faulty. I said, Lou, where is Jan Karman, my buddy? He said, Ed, I'm very sorry. About 3 weeks after the raid on our hut, Jan Karman was caught in another raid. And he was executed in the dunes in Holland. He lies buried in the cemetery for Dutch resistance fighters. That year, 1992, everything kept on changing. First I find out they survived, then I find out that the one who I thought of, the ones who I thought were dead had survived, the one that I thought had survived with me was now dead, supposedly. I went with Oscar Jr. to the place where the hut stood. And that's the first time that I could see that I felt that 50 years had gone by. That wood, that tangle of undergrowth and Christmas trees was now a forest of stately pine trees. I could look straight through it from one end to another. 50-year-old trees. And in the center where the hut once stood, I wanted to have a little piece of wood, a little piece of glass, anything to take back home. And there was nothing. The only thing there was a slight depression in the ground where the hut had stood. And so my wife and I traveled back to the United States. That was in the summer of 1992. And this used to be my graphic studio, this place, and I'm working here. In the meantime, computers have come in, of course, and everything. And I get a telephone call from Holland. Hans von Wildenberg, my interviewer for the radio broadcast, says, hey, Ed, could you come to Holland? Could you come back to Holland? I said, what for? He said, well, I've got a television program now, and it's about a half an hour. And I said, well, what's it about? Well, he says, it's about the Jewish persecution, and it's also about the Dutch resistance, and you're both this thing involved. I would like to re-interview you on my TV program. I said, well, I'll tell you the truth. I don't have a budget to fly to Holland for 20 minutes. You know, I really, Hans. He said, oh, no, we pay you all your costs for travel and hotels. I said, I'll be there. So I found myself sitting on a settee with a little Christmas tree next to me because the program was going to be broadcast on Christmas Day. And I'm sitting there, and there's my interviewer from the summer program, except now with the red Christmas tie. And I've been, by this time, I've been alone on TV, and so I've been interviewed many times. So I give the right answer to the right question so the program can roll along. Where were you? I was in hiding. I was in the woods. What happened? We were raided by the Germans. And what happened then? My buddy and I, we fled. What happened to your buddy? I said, I visited his grave yesterday. Well, up to then, the interview went fine. Then he says to me something that was very, very puzzling. He says to me, I want you to know, Mr. Lessing, that we have received a diary from your buddy in which he describes how the hut was built and all that. And I said, oh, that's very interesting, but there was a live audience. Oscar with his whole family, you know, Oscar Jr. and my cousin was there with the whole family and friends, everybody was there. I wasn't going to screw it up, and so I said, that's very interesting. I said, but I knew Jan Kamman couldn't have written a diary. He was arrested 3 weeks after the raid on Auer. He was shot and in, I think, February. And he couldn't have written a diary. He was on the run. So I said, well, it's very interesting. But then my interviewer said something that really almost made me go to my knees. He said, Mr. Lesney, I want you to know your buddy is here to talk with you. He'd like to speak with you. And I just visited his grave the day before. And out walks a very tall man with silver hair, rushes over and grabs my hands and said, Ed, thank God you survived. I didn't know if you would make it, you know. I said, who are you? He said, I'm Hermann Bühninghoff. Now, by this time, I had seen the pictures and I knew there was a Hermann Bühninghoff there. I said, why are you here? He said, Ed, we stood guard together. Your mother gave me her bicycle and a flashlight. I said, it was you? He said, yes. I said, what about Jan Kamman? He said, no. He said, you talked Lou into the wrong thing. I said, it was you. So here we go again. We hug and we cry and we do, and this is a half hour program, and the you know, the interviewer tried to keep the program still with it. anyway, it's over and we're off and we're sitting down and they have champagne. The whole crew is there, you know, this is like something amazing. I said, Hermann, I said, where the hell do you come from? He said, the TV people brought me here to talk with you. He said, didn't you know that? He said, I didn't know anything. They set me up here, you know, that's what they did. And I said, where do you come from? He said, they didn't tell you? He said, they didn't tell me anything. Where the hell do you come from? He said, I come from Indonesia. You come from Indonesia? Why? Where in Indonesia? He said, from New Guinea. I said, wait a minute. I remember now you were studying to be a notary public. Are you a notary public in New Guinea? He said, no, Ed. I said, Hermann, what is this mystery? I said, what do you do in New Guinea for a living? Well, he said, Ed, I wouldn't call it a living. And it gets to be more and more mysterious. I feel I'm, you know. I said, Hermann, please tell me what is going on here. What are you doing in New Guinea? He said, Ed, I've become a Catholic bishop. He said, I'm stationed in New Guinea. We built hospitals for the natives and all that. I've been a bishop for 40 years. And so I traveled back to America where my wife was waiting at JFK. And she says, so how did it go with that TV interview? I said, I'm going to tell you something very interesting. For a nice Jewish boy like me, I've got a very good friend who's a Catholic bishop in New Guinea. And that's where I usually end this story. So, if there are any questions that you have.
Well, that's quite a story. It's more than one quite a story, I should point out. I just want to pick up, we've been talking now for over 2 hours, and it's been great. It's been a fabulous to hear your stories.
I thought maybe... which we always used to do at the Shoah Foundation interviews, if there were still pieces like photographs or something.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. But after I turn off the camera, I'll photograph. I can photograph them later. I do have to. How long did your parents survive the war? I mean, your family was reunited. Everybody survived, which is a miracle. How your parents lived a normal life after that?
They lived a very good life. My father, actually, this was his best time in his life. He became first cellist of the Springfield, Massachusetts Symphony, and he was second cellist in the Hartford Symphony. He formed the string quartet. They played in the Pittsfield, Massachusetts Museum on Sundays, concerts. It was a golden time for my father. And my father also, during the hiding time in a room, he had begun had to do something. Couldn't play cello because people might outside might hear cello in that house where there was nobody else, you know. So he had begun to paint. So he continued painting after the war in Springfield, and he made many, many paintings. And I was, being an artist myself, I never said it to him, of course, but I also said it to my brothers. I said, Pop was the only artist I know who got progressively worse as the time went on. But Pop painted, and there's some beautiful paintings hanging, I'll show to you as you go out, in the front room.
And your mother?
And my mother, I'm amazed, this woman who had saved her whole family's life, and by the way, also saved Herman Muninghoff, my buddy's life, because I'll attach this here.
Herman Muninghoff, who later became the bishop.
The one who became the bishop.
Yeah.
As we were talking, he said, don't you remember your mother saved my life? I said, yes, I know. He said, you don't even know. I said, what do you mean? He said, do you remember your mother gave me her bike and that little flashlight? I said, yes. He said, you know, I pedaled away. I wasn't more than a mile away from you guys when a German sprang up in front of me. He said, Hop, get off the bike, stand over here. There was a little pump house there, he said. I had to stand there, you know, with my arms up and everything. He frisked me from top to bottom for weapons. If your mother hadn't said, bury your guns, I would have probably been executed right there. As it was, he said, he got a little guts again. He said, what are you doing? He said to this German. He said, what are you doing? He says, yes, said the German, I know. You're one of these resistance guys from the hut from this morning, from the raid we've been trying to catch. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. I come from night school. He said, my mother is waiting with dinner. He said, this is her bike with the wooden tires, you know. So the German says, what are you studying, huh, in that night school? He says, I'm studying to be a notary public. Oh, said the German, notary public. He seemed to know a little bit about that. And he said, Herman said, I seem to get what was going on here. He wanted that flashlight. He didn't give a damn about me or the bicycle. He wanted that flashlight. Now I have to explain. During that time, nobody had seen batteries for years. Philips made a little hand generator. You had one, you were a millionaire if you had one, because you were the only one who could still give a little bit light at night. And when there was no more electricity in Holland. And those things were worth a fortune, and he wanted that little hand dynamo. And so Herman said, "See, keep the flashlight, I don't need it. My mother is waiting, you don't want that lousy bike, the rattly bike." He said, let me go to my mother, she's waiting, you know, with dinner. He said, "You, I don't know why you're keeping me here." So the German said, go, gay. So he said, I got on my bike and I very slowly pedaled away, trying to not rush away, you know. And again, your mother saved my life again. So I didn't know that. That's another. So that's like an attachment that I'm adding on to you. Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's hard to top.
It's hard to top.
I know. Do you ever ask yourself, last question, I think, we've been talking a long time, and like I said, it's been great. Do you ever ask yourself why you were lucky enough to survive? I mean, was it just luck? Was it your mother's? You must have asked yourself that over the time.
My brothers and I, when we get together, invariably get to some point where we say, how the hell did we survive? I mean, Holland is the worst place to survive. To hide in a land that was flat, that had no mountains, no real forests, nothing. To hide there, and yet 6,000 Jews hid in Holland, and I think 3,000 or so were caught. 3,000 survived, or something like that. But we always question, because, by the way, my whole Cub Scout group, 28 boys, plus the leaders. Only three survived, myself and two others. I do watercolor paintings, and I've made a painting of my Cub Scout group from a photograph that was taken the day that I got my tie, and it's been accepted. The painting has been accepted in Amsterdam in the Jewish Historical Museum. It is there, so I'm very proud of that. They're all wiped out, so. Here we are, my two brothers and I, still alive. My parents, you ask how long have they survived? My mother got to be 83, and my father got to be 85. I will give you a little piece of paper when we part. That's what I've written about the death of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
I used to publish a little newsletter for the Hidden Child Foundation. Mm-hmm. But now I'm quite old, and we just came back from the yearly conference of the child survivors, and there we were 500 child survivors eating and sitting together at tables, eating and talking and getting old, straggling and doing, dying off. But this is my story, and I'm putting together albums from the first Lessing, which is a story in itself, by the way, which I'll attach here just for the hell of it. In late 1700s, a Jew from, I think, Lithuania, decides to come to Holland and settles in the city of Haarlem as a teacher. Now, the only thing I think a Lithuanian could teach in Holland, he doesn't know Dutch, and nobody wants to learn Lithuanian or whatever they speak there. So he must have been a Hebrew teacher.
Right.
In 1812, the year 1812, he appears in the town hall of Haarlem and asks that his name, his name, by the way, is David something like David Lettish.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly David Lettish. He asked in town hall in 1812 his name to be changed to David Lessing. Not a clue why. I have the transcript, it's in French, because Holland is under the rule of Napoleon. So that's the first Lessing. And I have all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest, the Jacobs, the Natans, the all of them. The Shulamites and the Rebeccas, and they all come down to my grandfather, Isaac. I knew my great-grandfather, remember, Jacob. His son, Isaac, was my grandfather. He had three sons, Nathan, Joseph, and Jacob. My mother's father was called Eliezer, as I told you. I was named after him. All Jews. And I'm putting that all in albums because now we have grandchildren. They don't know any Dutch. They look at pictures of people from the 1800s and they have the faintest idea. And if I don't safeguard it now, it's going to go in the wastebasket,
right?
Because they'll say, I wonder what language this is. Well, I don't know what that is, you know. So I'm recording as much as I can of this whole story, especially my mother's Bergen-Belsen stories and her writings and all that. That's it about.
Well, I'd like to thank you for sharing it with us today.
You're welcome.